This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Resolute Square.
There was also maintained what was called an enemies list, which was rather extensive and continually being updated.
Democrats want Republicans dead.
Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay?
The women with the least likelihood of getting pregnant are the ones most worried about having abortions.
On January 6th of 2021, you had tens of thousands of people peacefully protesting.
No, it's not a right-wing conspiracy theory. It's not QAnon. It's real.
I'm Rick Wilson, and this is The Enemies List.
My guest today is the writer David Masiotra. David has a tremendous new book out right now called Exurbia Now, The Battleground for American Democracy. And this is a subject, I was telling David before the show, that fascinates me because American political life has been reshaped by the suburbs and exurbs in the last 40 to 50 years, more than the cities have reshaped it in probably an even longer period of time. The post-war boom into the suburbs changed America. And so as the suburbs became the targets of white flight in the 50s and 60s, they slowly became more diverse. They changed. They became more reflective of America. And so we're now seeing white suburban conservatives, particularly, running further away. And David has written a fascinating book about this. I welcome him to the show. David, thank you so much for joining us today. I think I described the phenomena we're watching correctly. Talk to us about how we went from an urban political culture to a suburban political culture to an exurban political culture in the space of the last half century.
Well, that was a great introduction. I mean, you nailed some of the major topics of the book, and it's a real pleasure to be with you to have this conversation today. So as you noted correctly, after the Second World War, a few factors went into the creation of the United States of America as a suburban nation and really shifted so much wealth and political power from the city to suburbia. Those main factors were Dwight Eisenhower creating the highways, so now families could commute into work. We also had housing developments, like, you know, perhaps most famously Levittown in New York, but that happened in Chicago, Detroit, Baltimore, everywhere. And then you have the more insidious factor that you mentioned of white flight. So I grew up in the Chicagoland area. White flight happened from Chicago to the suburbs in the 60s and the 70s. And then there was a second stage of white flight during my childhood in the 1990s, in which people moved out of the south suburbs of Chicago into northwest Indiana, maybe even into southern Michigan, and maybe even further south in Illinois. And now what's happening is the exurbs, and for those in your audience who may not know, because I'm always asked this question, so I'm not being patronizing. An exurb is a town of greater distance from the nearest metro area than a suburb, but less people, so less population density. So we can measure it in terms of distance and density. And as the Wall Street Journal notes, and I document and describe in the book, an exurb tends to be an area of higher income than the average suburb. So the Wall Street Journal reports that median household income in exurbia is 15 to 20% higher than median income across the board. The significance of this politically is Donald Trump's support is off the charts in exurbia. And it's a crucial constituency that so much of the mainstream media conversation misses in their rush to focus on rural voters and so-called working class voters. The most psychotic members of Congress, so some of your favorites, Rick, like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz and Jim Jordan and Lauren Boebert, they represent districts that are predominantly exurban. So what I'm trying to do in the book, Exurbia Now, is examine what can we learn about exurbia. And once we've learned those things, how does that help us better understand the authoritarian right-wing threat? Because exurbia has become its number one staging and breeding ground. You're correct to note that exurbia is the later stage of white flight. It's mainly white, middle to upper middle class Republicans who are trying to escape the increasing diversity and in some cases progressive politics of suburban areas and large metro areas.
I mean, I remember when I was in college in Washington, D.C., just across the river, Arlington, Alexandria, Northern Virginia was a rock-ribbed Republican stronghold. It was as Republican as it got. And the rest of Virginia was pretty Republican as well. Those suburbs, I watched it evolving in the 80s and 90s, that those suburbs, Fairfax, Loudoun, Fauquier, down into Fredericksburg and running south, they became more diverse. They became more politically progressive. And now you've seen southwestern Virginia turn into something that doesn't even look like America in a lot of places. It is so far out there on the political belief scale that it's really hard for people to understand like how dark and weird it's gotten.
Yes, that's exactly it. So then the same thing happened where I grew up in, like I said, the south suburbs of Chicago. The south suburbs of Chicago were pretty politically diverse. I mean, there were often Republican congresspeople in those districts. Now, not so much anymore. They've become much more diverse in terms of demographics and much more progressive. The same thing has happened in the suburbs surrounding Atlanta, Phoenix, Philadelphia. So as the suburbs have taken on more progressive characteristics, have become more welcoming and friendly to LGBTQ Americans, have become more multiracial, this darkness and weirdness that you describe has taken off in exurbia because people who are living there are feeling, first of all, estranged from American culture. And that's one thing that people don't talk about nearly enough in terms of the MAGA movement, is how estranged and alienated these people are from American culture, which is why they react with hostility from everything to everything, from Taylor Swift to the Barbie film to any kind of seemingly anodyne mm-hmm. pop cultural development. The overwhelming majority of megachurches are in exurbia. That began as a practical matter because it's difficult and expensive to build a church the size of a basketball arena in a densely populated suburb or in the middle of Chicago or Washington, D.C. So exurbia has the space and the cheap land for it. Well, now, because these megachurches at best preach the prosperity gospel, which is destructive and insane, and at worst function as citadels of theocratic Christian nationalism, act as magnets for right-wing radicals and extremists to exurbia. Because if people are devout, they want to live near their church. Exurbia sure. often is a news desert. So you have people living in isolation in exurbia because there isn't much public space. There aren't many third places in the classic sociological sense. They're also living in epistemological isolation because they're news deserts. There's no local media. So on a daily basis, they're ingesting this drug of paranoia and prejudice from increasingly bizarre and reactionary right-wing media. And that only enhances the politics of exclusion and fear and rage and resentment that brought them to Exurbia in the first place. So it's this really disastrous and dangerous symbiosis that's happening in Exurbia. And that's why I call it a battleground for American democracy, because that's where the threat to democracy most exists. And these are people, too. I'll add one final thing. First of all, there are more of them than rural voters. And second, they actually have some money. I'm not saying that they're rich, but they have some money to donate to political campaigns. They have money to subscribe to Stephen Bannon's podcast and support this whole ecosystem of paranoia and hatred and authoritarianism.
I mean, a lot of these places, folks, you would recognize them. It's what I jokingly call generica. It's the wasteland of big homes on big lots in big developments, and the main physical, you know, artifacts around them are big box stores, Walmart, Costco, Sam's, all the various chain restaurants. It's the part of America that, weirdly, you mentioned that there's no third space. There's no gathering points in these communities, really. So essentially, a lot of it now is mediated not by the old things that drove the suburbs, which were commuting, television, and a cultural infrastructure of the things that used to exist, the Rotary clubs and the VFW halls and those sort of things. And these places are much more alienated from any of the infrastructure of civic life, right? But they do have, you know, the same sort of like 10 chain restaurants and the same sort of 10 chain stores. And basically it seems to me like they're living their lives in this way that's mediated a lot by cable news on Fox and the sort of online space where the right has become defined by its online culture.
Yeah, so you call it generica. In Exurbia now, I refer to it as Nowhere USA, because the economic landscape is entirely corporate chains. And there isn't much public space. There aren't local events like music festivals. As I said, there aren't local newspapers. So what happens is there's a culture of isolation. And as Robert Putnam, the great political scientist, warns in his classic Bowling Alone,
yep,
where isolation lives, extremism thrives. So
yes,
you have people who aren't associating with their neighbors much. These neighborhoods, in fact, often lack sidewalks. And I quote one urban planner in the book as saying that the reason these neighborhoods lack sidewalks is because sidewalks communicate hospitality. And if you don't have sidewalks, you're going to keep people out of the neighborhood that you don't want in the neighborhood. So when you're living in these types of conditions, as the great band Sunvolt sings in their song Exurbia, life is just home, work, car, road. When that's life and you don't have a local newspaper profiling a Latino immigrant who lives nearby, or a Black Lives Matter activist, or a gay or transgender teenager, and you're not meeting people at local events, you're not communing with people, you're much more susceptible to the slanderous lie that all of your problems or everything that threatens the United States is identifiable
those
with
people.
Yes, exactly. With Latino immigrants or with LGBTQ people or the liberals, the elite left or the coastal elites. So people living without an organic sense of culture and without community increasingly fall for these traps and end up romanticizing something that never really existed. The real America that Sarah Palin talked about, the white family with the picket fence going to church on Sunday mornings. And we don't have to worry about those pesky things like previously exiled and dispossessed groups using the mechanisms of democracy to reform the country and strive toward greater equality and freedom.
This show is sponsored
by BetterHelp. You know, folks, there are always things people need to get off their chests. We carry around a lot of stress in this world. Some of it's big, some of it's small. But all of it, if we keep it bottled up, can affect our health in a negative way. Therapy is a safe place to get things off your chest, to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down, to learn how to deal with those stresses. I know so many people who've benefited so much from therapy. They find a safe place where they can talk about the challenges in their life, where they can learn positive coping skills, they can learn how to set boundaries, and they can learn how to assess what's happening in their world in a way that makes them that better version of themselves. Therapy isn't just for people who've been through trauma or suffered a loss. It's for everyone. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Make your brain your friend with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Wilson today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Wilson. It is interesting to me that we have this ongoing sense that the isolation and the sort of loneliness in this country doesn't come from this sort of cultural siloing. I mean, a lot of people have described it as a symptom of the cultural siloing, but I think it's actually a cause of it. I think that lack of a national sense of this propositional, big, messy democracy is so distant from people now that they almost take offense when you describe it to them anymore. They almost get angry about it. And, you know, the founders did not intend for this country to be, you know, a blood and soil nationalist whites only, or one particular religion only. They thought about it having a broad array of views and beliefs. And they knew it was never going to be easy. But I think in a weird way, it's like the siloing is like a cheat code for people to not have to think about what the country is or was intended to be.
Support for Rick Wilson's The Enemies List comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/Wilson. That's odoo.com/Wilson. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Yeah, I think that's very insightful, and it reminds me of this simultaneous conversation that's taking place about the increasing amount of anger and estrangement in young men. I teach at a university, and the young men who have difficulty making friends, difficulty in class, are often from these increasingly right-wing areas. And they're estranged from their peers and the culture of their peers. And they walk into the classroom very angry and itching for a fight because they're ready to declare something woke or declare something part of the nefarious left-wing agenda. And I see exactly what you're saying, that the siloing isn't the symptom, it's the cause. And it's often the cause of the feeling of isolation and alienation in these young men. We can broaden that out and extrapolate insight into the entire culture. There is simply not a shared sense of belonging and purpose.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Oh yeah. Oh, believe me, the left wing has its share of, and again, I'm not subscribing to the whole, you know, right wing victimology, but there is an element of the sort of, and I think it came out of the 60s in a lot of ways, that sense that there were people who felt like, you hate the fact that X or Y is a Christian, you hate the fact that they're in a traditional marriage, and there was some of that the left, you know, in its sort of feistiest moments in the 60s, gave Republicans and gave conservatives reasons to believe that they were the persecuted class. Now, look, a lot of it was very thin. A lot of it was very contrived. But there were people who didn't wake up every morning and think, I want to live in a commune, or I want this or that. Some of it was racial. Some of it was not. But I think at the point we're at now, there is a very deeply wired set of negative political incentives that make the right in this question much more committed to this idea that we're going to have, you know, separate culture, separate countries, you know, living inside one border technically, but very radically altered in what their political, you know, and cultural lives are.
Yes, and also there is the sense that that is prevalent on the right wing, that they have ownership of the country. So therefore,
there is a lot of that.
Yes. So therefore, anything that attempts to push the country in a leftward direction is the result of some usurpation, some interloper. It's no coincidence that Joe Biden is viewed as an illegitimate president. Barack Obama was viewed as an illegitimate president for different reasons, of course. And Bill Clinton, and by many on the right, was viewed as an illegitimate president. And that's because, as Clint Eastwood said when he was speaking to an empty chair during his 2012 RNC speech, you know, this is our country. And exurbia is now perhaps the last refuge of escapist politics, because there's only so far they could go, because it's there that they've been able to create something of a white right-wing enclave that feels like a sanctuary for their politics.
Where do they run next?
Mm-hmm.
Where do they run next? Because right now, a lot of exurbia is built on former farmland and cattle land. And as a Florida guy and as a person, you know, whose family's in agriculture for a long time, you only get to harvest one last crop of 5,000 square foot suburban homes. Once you harvest that crop, it's done. And I'm curious about the sense of like, where do they run to next? Is this their last stand? I mean, because there just aren't that many more places where they can go and say, you know, this is where I draw the line. This is the last, you know, this is the last point where I will not give up any more of my imaginary culture.
Right. Well, that's one of the theses of my book, is that the right wing for a long time now has existed in a fight or flight mode. And once the options for flight dwindle, they will enter fully into the fight mode. And we've already seen that. That's what Donald Trump represents. That's what January 6th was all about. So that question, where do they go next, becomes increasingly worrisome. Because once right-wing voters, and more to the point leaders, feel as if they no longer have a refuge from what they see as creeping secular progressivism and hedonism and everything else, they will turn against the system, and many of them already have, that made the things they despise, but that you and I might celebrate, possible. And that's the system of democracy. It's constitutionally moderated democracy that made the civil rights movement possible, made the feminist movement possible, made the disability rights movement possible, the gay rights movement.
If I may speak Republican for a moment to my former Republican friends, it also made things like the pro-life movement possible.
Yes.
It also made things like the Second Amendment movement possible, where you get to go out into the culture and fight these issues in a way that is small d democratic. And if you think that fighting them in a way that is not mediated by a democracy, in a representative democracy, in a constitutional republic is going to work, you know, the world is littered with bad examples of that.
Right. And that's a great point. And it's also what made something of a conservative, quiet revolution in this country happen. The end of the New Deal consensus and the emergence of Ronald Reagan. There's a bit of it can't happen here mentality in Exurbia. And there is an increasing detachment from the consequences of their actions, but it's all scaffolded by this belief that no matter what, the left is worse.
100%. I cannot emphasize enough how that particular formulation, and it was mostly executed by Roger Ailes in a very deliberate way, to tell Republican voters, no matter what you think, no matter what you think about X or Y, the Democrats are worse. They're coming to kill you. They're coming to, you know, bring the bad people into your neighborhood, into your city, into your county, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That is a hardcore truth about the Republican political culture in this country.
And Trump captured that very well in 2020 when he spoke directly to fearful and angry residents of Exurbia and suburbs and smaller metro areas, when he said, without any basis in reality, of course, but that's typical, right, that Joe Biden was going to appoint Cory Booker as a suburban czar to fill the suburbs with low-income housing. I mean, the racial coding there is pretty obvious.
I'd say it's more of a air raid siren than a dog whistle.
Right, yeah, exactly. But that's in Trump's crude and simplistic way, he captured the mindset of the exurban voter, that we have to create these enclaves of refuge to escape blacks and Latinos and Asians who are on the march, to escape progressive politics, to escape LGBTQ people. And that is why, for example, as I report in the book, that the number one common characteristic of the aspiring fascists who stormed the Capitol on January 6th was residency in an exurban county where the non-white population is growing. So that's what, to use the vogue term radicalize, that's what radicalized those people. The non-white population was growing, and research also indicates that oftentimes in those same counties, the black-white poverty gap was shrinking.
Interesting. And it's interesting because that's actually a pretty big sample when you get down right to it. You've got a couple thousand of these J6 people. That is really interesting.
And at first, the media jumped on this idea that this was somehow the cry of the working class, that the average J6er was the reincarnation of Tom Joad. But subsequent research and study has indicated that there were poor people a part of that insurrection. There were working class people, but overwhelmingly, the majority of these people were middle class and even upper class. They were small business owners and people who are successful in the trades. So it's not economics.
Look, there were certainly people that came there and they were staying in the Willard, you know, and the Trump Hotel for $600-$700 a night. They weren't there because they just saved up their disability checks.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And they bought the plane ticket.
And I do think that there's a degree of mental attachment to the image of being working class, even when they're more upper income than working class. There's an idea of virtue in saying, oh, I'm just a regular guy. I drive a truck, but it's a $200,000 Ford F-450.
Right.
Not an actual work truck or what have you. I'm just interested in a lot of that, the cultural excuse making of feeling oppressed because, you know, a guy who affords a, you know, $700,000, $800,000 home in Exurbia and, you know, drives a, you know, $250,000 worth of vehicles between him and his wife and his kids, and essentially lives a very different life than the striving idea of, you know, the guy out there turning a wrench in a factory somewhere, still wants to have the same like virtue of that. I find it's a telling and I think fascinating look at how, again, people like Roger Ailes built a self-image for these people that, oh my God, you're so oppressed. You're an affluent guy who lives in the suburbs, in an expensive property, but you're so oppressed. They're so after you. Don't you think you have to fight back?
And then we get the absurdity of, I actually write a bit about the heavy duty pickup trucks in the book, but we get the absurdity of guys who don't use it for labor or use it very rarely, purchasing a $50,000, $60,000 pickup truck and then complaining about gas prices.
Correct.
Whenever a Democrat is in power. So they buy the worst gas guzzlers available. And then, of course, claim that they're angry with Democrats because fuel costs a dollar more at the pump. But there's also, you're making a very keen insight here with, there's also this cultural signification that we've spent so long in this country identifying everything virtuous and everything true red, white, and blue Americana with the hard hat worker carrying his lunchbox into the factory or the mill or on the farm, that there's a rush for these exurbanites to identify as a character in a Bruce Springsteen song or a character in a John Mellencamp song. And so much of the conversation surrounding class, particularly as it relates to politics in this country, falls for that trap. So, for example, we don't talk about the fact that the fast food chain Arby's employs more people than the entire coal industry. We don't talk about how there are millions of home health care aides who are the new face of the working class. And we get trapped by the politics of nostalgia, and we get trapped by an insidious form of identity politics that once again spotlights a certain male, often white worker in our relationship of class and politics. And it's very destructive and it's very dangerous, but it's what allows Donald Trump, for example, to pretend like he's Eugene Debs, like he's some blue collar hero. Right, when in reality, he's living in a penthouse and flying on his private jet and has nothing to offer the home health care worker or the Arby's worker or anyone else.
Right. So what was the most surprising thing? What was the most interesting thing you discovered in writing this book?
Well, one thing that comes to mind, and you alluded to it earlier, is that where there are more chain restaurants, there's a higher voter turnout for Republicans. And this is not only true in exurbia, it's true in urban areas, suburban areas, rural areas. And researchers were absolutely baffled by it. The theory that I submit in exurbia now is that the corporate chain appeals to someone who wants an antiseptic, predictable experience. And that relates to a certain mindset that is becoming increasingly prevalent in Republican politics. But what I would also say in response to that question is, even though we've been talking about the darkness and the weirdness for the past 20 to 30 minutes, it's a very hopeful book, because one thing to understand is that what's happening in exurbia and happening more broadly with right-wing politics is reactionary and reactive. And it's only because the United States has made so much progress toward equality and diversity and on women's issues, on racial issues, on a whole series of other issues, that these voters have become so enraged and extreme. So therefore, it becomes essential to participate at the local level as well as the national level, because as you know better than I do, right-wing organizers are very focused on localities and local races, everything from the school board even to library trustee positions.
Listen, in Florida, one of the ways the Republicans took over Florida, I've told this story before, we went out and we said, okay, let's start electing people to the local soil and water conservation district. Let's start electing people to the mosquito control board. Let's start electing people to the community arts board. And that led to sheriffs and county commission seats, and that led to state senate seats, and then congressional seats, and on and on and on. Down low organizing, man, it's a thing. It's a real thing.
Yeah, and the left has so consistently neglected those races that they're behind the eight ball in many of these states, and that's a big problem, and that's something I write about in the book.
God love him. We're friendly, but you know. Democratic donors have put roughly $250 million into Beto O'Rourke in Texas in the last couple cycles. Imagine half that money, a tenth of that money going out to try to get county commissioners elected in North Carolina or Georgia or Florida. It would really change the ballgame. There's a tendency among Democratic mid-dollar and small-dollar donors to run for the celebrity candidate and flood the zone with money, and everybody else starves down the food chain. So it's interesting.
And all of that funding that you mentioned contributed to the redistricting in recent years that has led to so much gerrymandering in many important states like North Carolina. And therefore, the residents of Exurbia have disproportionate amount of political power. Just like it with the Electoral College nationally. So these exurban residents wield tremendous influence in their respective states because Republicans have been much more strategic and sound in emphasizing their constituencies than the Democrats have been. And that's a really sad and scary thing for our democracy, given how the Republican Party has shifted further and further to the extreme right.
Well, David, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. This is a fascinating book. I recommend it, folks. And studying the changes of American demographics and where we live is the driving, how it's become the driving aspect of political choice and political identity. It's a fascinating book. I recommend it. David, thank you for coming on the show. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you so much. I hope so.
Folks, it's about a week ago now that you heard the story of Christy Nome killing her dog, Cricket. Now, look, Christy Nome was a hot commodity in the Republican Party, a hot flavor. She was going to be the VP. She was going to be the one who was rising. She's gorgeous, great hair, looks great, tall, thin, fit, all the things that Donald Trump and his weird, I want somebody from central casting way thought a vice president should look like. And she writes a book. She writes a book about her life in South Dakota. And she puts a chapter in there about the fact that she killed her dog, Cricket, a puppy, 14 months old, because the dog was too rambunctious, too energetic, too sharp, as we say in the hunting world, on birds. Killed some chickens. So she took it out, and she took it to a gravel pit, and she shot it in the head with a shotgun. Guys, I've been hunting my whole life. I've been around birds and bird dogs for 30 years now. More. I have never, God knows how many dogs we've had. I've never, even for the worst dog I've ever had, the most unsuitable, non-fit field dog I've ever had, put a bullet in one. You know what that non-suitable field dog that I have is? Her name is Jane. She spins in circles all the time. She's spastic. She's flailing. She's not a dog for the field. But you know where she is right now? She's laying on my couch. You know what she does every day? She plays with the cats. She is friendly with everybody in the family. She loves everybody all the time. She runs. She plays. She has a great life. I never thought for a second about shooting her in the head because she wasn't working out as a field dog. The fact that Kristi Noem did this, it's not just about shooting the dog. It's about what she's trying to tell America that she is. And what she's trying to tell America that she is a really terrible monster. She's trying to say to Donald Trump, that was written, by the way, for an audience of one person. It was to tell Donald Trump, I'll do what you want, master. I'll kill who you want, sir. I'll do whatever horrible, dark, crappy, mean, cruel, sadistic, illegal thing you need, Donald. If I'll kill a dog, I'll do anything for you. Now, I will tell you one thing, folks. You're often listening to this show and you're thinking that a person like Kristi Noem obviously belongs on the enemies list, and so does everybody that supports her. The most fascinating thing, and I look at this, it's a low bar, but a tiny, itty-bitty glimmer of hope in America, is that even the MAGA people turned on her. Everyone ratioed the living bejesus out of her. That woman is the most hated person in America right now. She is the dog killer lady for the rest of her life. She doesn't ever get to get away with this. When even weirdos on the MAGA right, like Cat Turd and Laura Loomer, are bashing the hell out of her, and Fox News does like 11 segments in 3 days bashing her, and everybody, every other normal person in America is equally bashing her, it tells you that killing dogs, that's finally a border. We finally found a line MAGA won't cross. It's killing dogs. You know what? I hate to say it, but I'll take it. Because everyone on the left, the right, and the center has put you, Governor Kristi Noem, firmly on the enemies list.
Thanks again for listening to the Enemies List. If you have any comments, questions, or if there's someone you'd like to hear on the podcast, hit me up on Twitter at TheRickWilson. Thanks again for the wonderful support you've shown the pod. We're growing fast. It really helps if you will share this with your friends, your family, and anyone else who, like us, is trying to save democracy. While you're at it, if you could rate and review the podcast, I would be very much appreciative. I know this is the sort of thing you've heard a billion times. Please rate, review, like, blah, blah, blah. But you need to do it. It really does help us a lot. We are slaves to the algorithm, my friends. And if you do this, it will help get the pod out further. Anyway, thanks again for listening. I'll see you next time. And remember, whatever you do, stay off the list.